You're listening to KTNA, Talkeetna. And now for Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the northern Susitna Valley. Created by your friends and neighbors at Pothole Productions and Talkeetna Community Radio. From comic relief to serious beliefs, each week brings you a fresh nugget. I'm Holly Stinson, and today we'll hear the second part of John Baker's adventures in Alaska. In the first nugget, we heard about Trapper John's first two trips up the highway from Michigan in the 1950s. That story ended with John starting out for his third trip to Alaska in a really pretty 57 Dodge.
And it was pretty, but it wasn't much good. And I think it only had 30,000 miles on it or something.
Oh, just broken in.
Oh, yeah, it was a beautiful car. Oh, yeah. It wasn't for these kind of roads.
Oh, yeah. A city car.
Yeah, it was definitely a city car. And I came up, and I was coming into Anchorage. And pretty soon, well, Anchorage didn't come out as far as it does now anyway, but anyway, I was starting to run into military guards along the road. And I forgot just where they stopped me down there, but they finally stopped me. And there wasn't much traffic on the road. Heck, you never hardly see any cars. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they stopped me. Pulled me over, and what's the deal? So they said, well, we got some people coming by pretty soon. The road has to be clear. You have to stay here until they come by. Well, I didn't know who it was. It turns out it was Eisenhower. He was, if you remember, he was going to Japan, and he was going to stop here. But while he was in flight, and Japan, this wasn't that long after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were in flight, Japan radio to them and stuff and says, we cannot guarantee your safety. Said that these, you know, the people were still really antagonistic towards the Americans for the atomic bomb and losing the war and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Eisenhower stopped in Anchorage and he never went further. He turned around and went back. But while he was there, I was standing right alongside the road. I was the only one around. And lo and behold, Eisenhower in this convertible. He wasn't driving. He was in the back seat. But it seemed to me he stood up and waved to me. But maybe he just waved to me. But Eisenhower waved.
Waved to you. That's your claim to fame.
Yep.
One of them.
So I saw Eisenhower, and he waved to me personally.
And you know it was to you personally because you were the only person around.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was waving to you personally.
Yeah, he did. And, I hollered hi, Ike, and all that goofy stuff, just like I always said I never would.
So you got here to Anchorage this was your third trip.
Yeah, and you know, I get mixed up on my years, but I think this was 1960. And there was no work to be had. I looked for work that summer. I don't remember. I think I went down on the Kenai. In fact, I know I did. I had some friends on the Kenai at that time. I went down there and spent some time with a friend, Roy Koshny. He was a fisherman down there, and he also made home brew. And so we made We made homebrew by the garbage pail full. And we knew where, he took me to where the best clam digging was. And in those days, you know, you could go clam digging and you might not see anybody. It was, it was a different world. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a great big steep embankment that you had to go down, and it was so steep there was a hanging rope there that was left.
Wow.
And that helped you to come back up. And it wasn't any problem, but it was a long ways up. It was, I don't know how far it was, it was 70, 80 feet high there, maybe more, whatever. And so, when you're young, you're looking for work, but there's always some fun, interesting things to do because there's people your same age, and we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
None of us can find work. And in those days, there just wasn't any. You made your own fun, you made your own whatever. And I always said you didn't really need money. You found somebody always had a roof someplace that you could get under.
Uh-huh.
And you could get salmon. So you had your fish. At that time, there were some potato farms back just outside of where the Anchorage International Airport is right now. And we could go there, and after the potato digger went across, you could go out in the field and take all you wanted, anything that was left. So we could get our fish, we could get our potatoes, we could get a moose. And all the time we're maybe looking for a job.
But you're still living pretty good. You're eating.
We live pretty good. And whoever had the roof, you'd help them do whatever they were doing. And it was a different way of life. And it was quite nice. And at that time, I'm trying to remember if that was... That might have been the year that I did get a job. They were, I think it was. They were, they started to build a city dock. And that was the original city dock. Before that, the only dock that was there was the Army dock. And it was a wooden dock. And it was getting old. And the city got their finances together enough to hire the DeLong Company out of New York. And that's something I can remember that. To build the city dock. And so that was on the city dock where I met Gene Lanzaro. He was to become my trapping partner. He
was working on that
yes.
job too.
Yep, mm-hmm. he was a rigger on that job. We were working out of the pile drivers union, and that's docks and bridges and offshore platforms and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that fall, when fall came, that's Gene had all his stuff together, and so he said if I wanted to go with him, if I just matched him in traps and supplies, we'd go.
Listen in to hear about the beginning of John Baker's trapping adventures in the Cahiltna River area with that partner that he met while working on the city dock, Jean Lancero. Finding a cabin is not always as easy as you would think it would be.
Jean was older than I, and I kind of looked to him as knowing more than I did. And sometimes that was quite a mistake. But anyway, Jean had been up here in the late 50s, and he had flown out, and he had been a good friend of, and mainly he was befriended by, Glenn Hudson. That was Cliff's older brother.
Okay.
And Gene needed a wing to be under. Glenn took him under and showed him a lot and helped him a lot and kept him out of trouble and took him out to Byers Lake. And Glenn flew in some building materials and helped Gene build a little cabin out there. And Glenn could use that for fishermen. He would take fishermen out on floats in the summertime, and Gene could use it in the wintertime. And so that was a pretty good arrangement. Gene did that for a while, and then his dad was having family problems back in the States, and so Gene left to go back and be with his dad. And so this was Gene's first year back, and by this time Glenn had died. He was killed in the plane wreck, and Oscar Bogle, another friend of Gene's, suggested we contact Don Sheldon and ask him where to go. And Oscar suggested the Cahilton River area. He knew of some catches, pretty good catches that had been made out that way. And so we contacted Don. And at that time, there was no road to Talkeetna. So Don flew directly into Merrill Field and picked us up at Merrill Field. And took us out to the Cahilton River. He flew around first and showed us about where there were some cabins. And some of these cabins had fallen in. They were old, but they had been there. And so he landed us and our supplies on a gravel bar out on the Cahilton River. And we set up a tent and proceeded to try to find the first cabin. You know, you look from the air and it's altogether different. And not only that, I was in the back and I was so covered up with bags and baggage.
Supplies.
I couldn't see out the window. I had no idea where I was. I didn't know what it looked like out there. The plane stopped and I got out from underneath the load. Well, so again, I'm depending on Gene as to where did it look like this cabin was. And he would have got lost in his own kitchen. So anyway, we set up the tent. And we looked for at least 2 days for that cabin. And these cabins, after a while, you know, they really blend in. You can walk within 20 yards of one and might not see it. So when you're looking for a cabin out there, the first tip-off that you start looking for is a sawed-off stump. Because, you see, they have to get firewood. And so, you're going through the woods. If you see a sawed-off stump, you know somebody's been here. So now you start looking around. And that's how we found the first cabin. And this cabin, you know, hadn't been used in many, many years. And we're only talking about something that's around maybe, I don't know, it's only maybe 6 by 8 feet.
Wow. Tiny.
It's very small, usually for one person. And these have to be made quick. Whoever's doing it is trying to get in out of the coal.
Mm-hmm.
And what do they have? All they had is a handsaw and an axe. There was no chainsaws, there was no anything in those days. Well, so these cabins are quite crude, and they're not very big. And when I say 6 by 8, I don't miss it by far. It might have been 7 by 9 or 6 by 8. I don't know. But we're not talking very big. In fact, for us to sleep in that cabin, we were along one wall. Gene is the shortest. So he had the narrowest spot, and my feet had to go past his head. And we slept in tandem like that. And there wasn't a lot of moving around to be done either.
There wasn't much space to do that, huh?
No, yeah. There was no space. And we had a little stove in there, and we had a little table, and we had to patch up all the holes in the logs. There was a lot, because, you know, it was just moss chinking in the first place, and there had been mice and squirrels and everything going in and out of this place for years. So it was, but the thing was better than the tent, and it was bigger than the tent. So
it was worth fixing up.
So it was worth fixing up, and it was quite an improvement over what we had for the last 2-3 days. And so Gene was sort of the cook. In fact, he never trusted my cooking. He was always afraid I'd put foreign objects in it. Well, his idea of foreign objects was, he hated liver, he didn't like gizzards, he wouldn't eat the heart, these were all foreign objects. And that suited me just fine. If Gene wanted to cook, he could cook. And I would get the wood and the water and all that. And generally, when we'd get to a cabin first, the first thing at night, we'd have a lantern going inside. You can go outside, and the light shows through all the cracks. So while Gene was in there with the light on, I'd be outside, and I could go around all these cracks, and I'd stuff in whatever we had. And a lot of our foods that we brought in were wrapped in newspapers a lot. And so we used newspapers a lot. We used cardboard a lot. You used whatever you had. And you'd go around and around the cabin, jamming this stuff in all these cracks. And then when you got them pretty good, if there was snow, you took your shovel and you banked up snow all around the cabin as high as you could go. Now, these cabins weren't very high in the first place, so if you went up 3 or 4 feet, you were up to the eaves. So anyway, that's the kind of the start of our partnership of trapping together on the Cahilka River.
Listening to Nuggets on KTNA. I'm Holly Stinson, and if you've just joined us, I'm visiting today with John Baker, known as Trapper John. He began trapping on the Kehltna River in the early 1960s with his partner, Gene Lancero. In this last portion of this nugget, we'll hear about Trapper John's two essential items, a radio and a dog.
And this went on, and because Gene had a house in town, which I had nothing, quite often, if we went in at Christmas, he wouldn't come back after Christmas. And so I would go in with him for Christmas, and I might even go out to see my parents over Christmas, but then I'd come back in a couple of weeks, and then I'd come out, I'd have to go back out alone, which was fine. But I did know I wanted a radio, so one year, that was probably 61, something like that, I worked all summer. I think I had about 10 days work. And I found right at the end there, there was some plasters. They were plastering a house out in Turnigan. And it was a pretty fancy house. They needed somebody to mix mud for them. So I'll tell you, and there was no mixers, there was no nothing. This is all done by hand. And those guys could put mud on. I mean, good grief. You get a couple of those guys together, and you can't mix mud fast enough. Well, I'll tell you, I earned whatever I got. But I got enough to buy a brand new Zenith Transoceanic radio. And I took that out with me. That was a big deal. That was that kind of doubled your whatever recreation you might have had. It more than doubled it. It tenfolded it. Now I was in contact with the world, really, because it had short wave, and I could get all different kinds of stations. And I remember listening to the first liftoff at Canaveral of the first space shuttle or whatever it was. In those days, it wasn't a shuttle. But whoever went into space first, I listened to it on the radio. It was pretty neat. Those were big deals. And of course, you listen to Reuben Gaines every night. That was a must. And the North Wind messages, those were musts.
But this was one-way communication.
Oh yeah.
You
could listen, but you couldn't.
But you couldn't communicate with anybody.
No. But those were pretty great.
That was a nice link to the outside world. Kept you sane.
It kept you posted. Everybody in the bush used it, so I knew what. You know, somebody was. The plane was going to go get somebody, or somebody had to come in, or somebody. It was a contact. You knew what people were doing. Mm-hmm. And also, the Cold War was going big with Russia. And so Radio Moscow was one of the most powerful stations we could get. And they beamed to the North American continent. And it was all in English. And it was very interesting. Very interesting. You know, it was slanted, but nonetheless very interesting. Anyway, the radio was a big deal. But then I was still missing something, and so that's the next time into town is when I looked for a dog. And that's when Cliff told me that there was a young couple living by the post office at that time. They were living where the post office now stands. It was a log cabin there, a two-story log cabin right there. And so that's when I knocked on the door, and Susie and a couple armloads of kids and a couple following her answered. told me that yes, they indeed did have a dog, and they she was a big dog, and she had just had a litter of pups, and they just wanted her for the pups, and they were willing to get rid of her. And so that's where Quinny and I met. And so Quinny and I started life together out on the trap line. And she was the first sled dog I ever had.
And would she go with you out on the trap line? I mean, you'd go by snowshoe?
Oh, totally snowshoes. This was all by foot. This was really, it was before any type of reliable snow machine.
Operative word, reliable. So you would go by foot, checking your lines.
Oh, yes.
And Queenie would come along with you?
She would come along with me, and she would pull a toboggan.
Oh.
Quite often. If there was any, especially beaver trapping, because beaver are heavy, and or if we were going between cabins, if I was going from one, my cabins were 10 miles apart. And if there was anything to carry between cabins, she would pull the toboggan. And that was deep snow country in those days. And she couldn't go unless I made a trail.
Yeah.
But once I made a trail, then it was no problem. She could pull two or three beaver. She could even bring in my firewood if I didn't load the sled too heavy.
Great. Very useful to have her for companion and for...
Absolutely.
For work.
Absolutely.
Now, can I ask a real stupid question? So when you trap these beaver and you say they're heavy, do you bring the whole animal back to the cabin?
Yes. Now, if the weather's mild... and you bring it out, and you had a long ways to go, you could do a rough skin. I have done that.
Mm-hmm. Like right there, and then
right.
Just...
Uh-huh. And I have done that. But if it's nicer to do it in the cabin. So basically, for the most part, I would bring them back to the cabin, and that'd give me something to do at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the nights are pretty long. And a lot of times, I would save skinning up. You could freeze them. Mm-hmm. Freezing's pretty easy. I would save them for Saturday, maybe. And that was another thing. With my radio, I could listen to the football games or anything like that. So that was really nice. You could just stay in a nice little warm cabin, and you could skin beaver and listen to the radio, and I mean...
It was a good life.
It was a great life.
I'm Holly Stinson, and I'd like to thank John Baker for visiting with me today in this second part of his adventures. In the last and third nugget with Trapper John, we'll hear stories of trapping, along with the amazing story of Queenie, the infamous aerial dog. You've been listening to Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the Northern Sioux Sitna Valley. Do you have a nugget you'd like to share? If you would like to host a show, be a guest on this program, or get involved in some other way, please call the station at 733-1700. You may also contact us through the website at ktna.org. You're listening to KTNA, Talkeetna.